Well, it's great to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name's Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore. For many of us, the Ten Commandments conjures a vision of Moses standing on top of the mountain with thunder and lightning as God inscribes his commands on two tablets of stone.
You shall not murder. You shall not steal. You shall never want what belongs to others.
The Ten Commandments has a lot more to do with our daily lives, whether we're aware of it or not, than images of Charlton Heston holding those tablets aloft. A lot of Western people, even if they're not Jewish or Christian, even if they couldn't name many of the Ten Commandments, will still say that they pretty much live by these ancient rules.
Our colleague here at CPX, John Dixon, who is an ancient historian, has a new book out. It's called A Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments, How, for Better or Worse, Our Ideas About the Good Life Come from Moses and Jesus. So, John, who are these doubters and why would they be interested in the Ten Commandments?
Well, the doubters are those who live in Western society who assume many of the ideas that have come from the Bible, but also assume none of their ideas comes from the Bible. And so I'm trying to explain that some of their best ideas didn't just appear to them in a dream one night. They've been gifted by a long historical tradition, and the Ten Commandments is part of that.
Most of us probably think we pretty much know what the Ten Commandments are, but to refresh some maybe dusty memories, where did they come from? What's the context for these principles?
Well, it comes from Moses, right? So we're sort of 1250 BC, Moses and the Israelites rescued out of Egypt by God, according to the book of Exodus, and God reveals to them 10 words. They're called words in the original rather than commandments. And these 10 words kind of sum up the good life for Israel. There are many more commandments in the Old Testament, but they're always seen as a kind of extrapolation of these 10 principles.
So, John, as a culture, we tend not to be all that keen on rules. We think of them as restrictive, but in your book you write that these rules are among the most comforting and freeing elements of existence. Now, how's that true?
Oh, I love soccer, and it's precisely the rules that give soccer the shape that it has that makes it the beautiful game. If life can be lived in a way that is a beautiful game, then there's got to be rules. A free form doesn't create any freedom at all.
But you also describe the negatives of the Ten Commandments. And let's be honest, they're almost all thou shalt not,
yeah,
as positive rather than a constraint.
That's awesome.
How are you selling this idea?
Oh, well, it's obvious because it's only negative grammar, thou shalt not.
Right.
But you mustn't be tricked into thinking it's negative tone or morality. I'm just back from skiing, right? And I tell you, when I'm at the top of Perisher, I don't want to know the 50 ways I'm allowed to get down the mountain. I just want to know the three places somewhere down the mountain I should not go. And they often put these lovely orange poles there to say, don't go here. That's all I want to know. I want to know, thou shalt not go here because, you know, you're going to ruin your life. Whereas most things in life, according to the Bible, you're allowed to do. I'd hate it, wouldn't you? If, you know, you were given a list of things you're allowed to do, or you're allowed to sneeze on Thursdays, you're allowed to, you know, it's just ridiculous. So
that'd
a few simple negatives mean that everything else is up for grabs, so go for it.
So are these just common sense? Like, does every society come up with something a bit like these commandments?
Oh, sort of, but none of them has been as popular as the... I mean, the extraordinary thing is Moses gave these, like, 1250 BC, and they are incredibly successful, way more successful than any other cultural meme or set of commandments. But there are some of the commandments that you would not have come up with yourself. I mean, most cultures were idol-worshipping cultures. They created little golden, you know, brick idols and bowed down to them. Well, the Israelites said, no way. Or the Sabbath. That's a completely novel idea in antiquity, the idea of taking a regular day off. So there are some things here in the Ten Commandments that are just sort of obvious, thou shalt not murder. And then there are things that are really surprising, like thou shalt not covet, or you know, take a day off a week.
So you think that they kind of seem obvious to us because they've had such a huge influence?
Partly because they've had a huge influence, and partly because we are creatures made in God's image. And so some of the things people come up with just as they ponder the universe without any inspiration from God, will reflect reality as God has made it. So it's not surprising that other cultures have some of these ideas, not at all.
John, the Ten Commandments and the moral teachings of Jesus are often conflated in popular understanding. What does Jesus have to do with the Ten Commandments? Where does he fit?
Well, the curious thing is the Ten Commandments really only influenced the West because of the teaching of Jesus. It wasn't that Jewish missionaries went out and converted the West to the Ten Commandments. These are Old Testament laws which Jesus picked up. And I use the analogy of a transposition of a musical score. Jesus transposed the Ten Commandments, and it was Christians who took the transposed vision of the Ten Commandments into all the world. And you can see this in many different ways. Jesus created the idea that the Sabbath was made for us rather than us being made for the Sabbath, and so it gave us flexibility around that. He interpreted the murder command as a command not to even hate or denigrate other human beings. He caused the key interpretation of the Ten Commandments to boil down to love God and love your neighbor. And that it's that idea that really took off throughout the Western world. And we can see the way it's affected our laws and philosophy and culture.
Let's look at this a little bit more closely, a few of the ten to begin with. So the first command can be a bit of a deal breaker for a lot of people. You shall have no other gods before me. Now, what does belief in God have to do with the good life? You don't have to be religious, do you, to be kind and loving and honest?
No, of course you don't. And there are lots of these moral intuitions that people have about what is a good life that someone like Aristotle had, you know, without a belief in the biblical God, although he did believe in the one behind everything. Anyway, so no, you could be an atheist and still pursue these morals. The thing that you can't have if you're an atheist is a profoundly all the way down logic for this vision of the universe. Only if there is a God whose character has shaped all of creation does it make profound rational sense to live a life that reflects the intention of the universe. And that's something that theism has over atheism, not in terms of the performance of the morals, but the logic of the morals, because God's character is imprinted on the universe. So if I live according to that character, I'm living how I'm meant to live in the universe.
Yeah, so without the belief, it becomes a preference.
Yeah, it's a preference. And you've got nothing as an atheist to say to your fellow atheist who says, no, I don't feel that. You think not lying to people's a good thing, but I don't agree with that. Or, you know, I mean, how would you answer Nietzsche, the great atheist, who said he thinks the compassion ethic that comes out of the Ten Commandments via Jesus is stupid because it defies the law of nature, which intends for the weak to be crushed and left aside.
You're listening to Life and Faith. If you've just joined us, we're speaking with John Dixon about his new book, A Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments.
One of the more attractive commandments to people is the Sabbath one, the one to rest. And actually, this one has had a huge impact on our society, hasn't it?
It gave us the weekend. It really did. And the funny thing is, like from a historical point of view, no one knows where it came from. I mean, of course, the Christian says, well, it came from God. But most scholars try and find some historical precedent to it. Did it come from Babylon or Egypt? And basically, after nearly a century of research, we've got no idea. It just appears out of nowhere. One day off in seven, and a day off that is not just for elites. Elites tried to have every day off, actually, if they could possibly do it. But the idea that even the worker in your field is to have a day off a week is striking and new and came into Western civilization. We can actually date it because there's a decree in the 4th century that mandates even workers having a day off. But it does it to give them rest. It does actually say you don't have to have the day off. If you're a farmer and you've got to bring in your harvest, by all means, do it. But basically, no one should be forcing everyone to work 7 days a week.
Yeah, I think we can all be pretty glad about that one. So what about the honour your father and mother commandment? That seems kind of quaint, kind of family values in the wake of the sexual revolution and how families have changed in recent decades. Is that still relevant? Is it just a way of, you know, traditionally keeping kids in line, making them obey?
Well, no. And it's interesting, isn't it, that it's the first human word commandment in the Ten Commandments, right? The first four are kind of God would. This heads the commandments about how you treat others, and it's about children honouring their parents. And I think the logic has to be something like, how else is society preserved and held in a way that embraces the good if children are not looking to their parents for the good. And so there's a sense in which the entire history of culture is contained in this one commandment. When a kid honors the parent and therefore listens to the cultural heritage, particularly the heritage of the Ten Commandments and then the heritage of the Christian faith, then they're hearing about the good life, they're seeing the good life from their parents. And the reality is that even way back then, the idea of husband plus wife plus children, the nuclear family, was the very core unit of society. There's no getting around that. You sometimes hear that we invented the nuclear society, you know, after the Industrial Revolution. But that's nonsense. Historically, that was the nuclear family. That was the nucleus of society. And of course, when a child grows up, they honor their parents in a different way. They honor their parents by caring for them as the elderly, as the weak of society. And this was also mandated in the Jewish and then the Christian tradition, and gave us aged care as we know it today. This commandment gave us aged care in a way that did not exist in Greece and Rome.
Now, John, you look fairly closely in the book at the commandment to not covet. So perhaps as you answer this, you can tell us what covet is. But this is an interesting one because it's stepping away from external behaviour and starting to think about internal desires. Is it even possible to regulate how we might view other people?
Well, one of the things I try and make clear in the book is that the Ten Commandments themselves expect that you can't do the Ten Commandments. And, you know, the whole Jewish law says that basically you can't, that you're going to fail. God's mercy toward you is the reason you should try and obey him, but you're not going to obey him, so you're going to need his mercy some more. Now, Jesus takes that and really runs with it and says you really can't obey this. And his vision of the Ten Commandments presses this home very profoundly. But the covet it doesn't just mean desire. I mean, it doesn't mean, you know, I love your jacket, Simon. That's a beautiful jacket. It means to wish for myself something that is properly yours. And we do this in all sorts of ways. We wish that that person's honor was not theirs, but mine. I want to stand in their place. So you're right. This one internalizes the commandments. Just when you thought you might be able to get through life without murdering someone, you're told you shouldn't be able to
have these thoughts.
These thoughts, yeah. And it goes to the real. It goes to our soul and bears our soul open, and of course drives us to God's mercy. In the New Testament, this commandment itself is reflected on quite profoundly. And as I try and explain in the book, St. Augustine in the 4th and 5th century reflected on this very commandment. And he chose to make it his sort of window into the human soul of how fallen we are, how our cravings are so disordered, and that this is what's wrong with the world. And God wants to forgive us and then reorder our loves or our coveting so that they're properly ordered, and that's what the good life is.
Is this sort of obedience of these laws the way in which we get approval from God?
Well, in the Ten Commandments, clearly not, because it starts with, I am the Lord your God who saved you out of Egypt, therefore have no other gods before me. So the very premise of the Ten Commandments is that it's because God loves you that you live this life of love toward God and neighbor.
So as we get into the New Testament, this becomes really important to think about Jesus and his relationship to these laws.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, in the Sermon on the Mount, the opening line of the most famous teaching of Jesus, the kind of Ten Commandments of Jesus, is blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, which means that the kingdom, God's way, the good life, let's say, is not open to those who think they are morally rich. It's up to those who know they're already bankrupt. And that's the doorway in to this vision of the good life. And it's so freeing because I wake up each morning knowing that I'm loved by God and that that's the reason I obey him. And when I mess up, as I invariably do, I realize that it's the poor in spirit who have the kingdom of heaven.
You've been listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart, and Natasha and I have been talking with John Dixon about his new book on the Ten Commandments and what they have to do with living a good life. If you want to know more, you can buy the book from our website at publicchristianity.org.
For more conversations like this, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just type Centre for Public Christianity in the search box to find us. While you're there, do leave us a rating or review. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we explore a world beyond sight with documentary filmmaker Peter Middleton.